ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the youth curfew in Alice Springs is being extended as authorities see a drop in crime in the territory town. Also, as tensions rise in our region, Australia is to get a new Chief of Defence. And when would you like to retire? Right now, most people are stopping work in their mid-60s, but the average age is going up each year.
So if we think about that over the next 20 years, we'll probably be pushing towards that 70-year age mark. And if we look at some sort of East Asian countries like Korea or Japan, you know, they're already at those levels.
First tonight, the youth curfew in Alice Springs is to run for an extra 6 days after police reported it's led to a significant drop in crime in the town. It was to run for a fortnight and end tomorrow morning, but the Northern Territory's Chief Minister has announced the curfew will now be in place until the end of the school holidays next Tuesday. While a nighttime lockdown hasn't been popular with everyone, some leaders were hoping the extension would be even longer so they could work on solving the youth crime crisis. This report from Gavin Koosh.
After hearing dozens of different perspectives in Alice Springs about whether to extend the curfew, Chief Minister Eva Lawler says the message was clear.
The overarching was that we need to keep the curfew in place, particularly over the school holidays. So it will end at 6 a.m. on the Tuesday morning. Monday's a pupil-free day, so it'll end on the Tuesday next week, the 16th.
The curfew, which was initially scheduled to end tomorrow morning, bans young people under the age of 18 from entering the town centre between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. without a valid reason. The emergency measure followed an extended period of social unrest in Alice Springs, which culminated in a series of violent incidents 2 weeks ago. Eva Lawler says locals have told her the curfew has made a difference.
The conversations on the ground from Alice Springs residents is this has been the best thing that's happened to Alice Springs. It really was a circuit breaker. People are feeling so much safer, so much more comfortable.
To help enforce the curfew, an extra 60 officers have been deployed to Alice Springs from across the NT, and another 20 have been sent from South Australia at the request of the police commissioner. Working alongside police officers are teams of social workers. Together, they've interacted with more than 300 young people in the no-go area during the curfew period. There have been no arrests as part of the curfew. NT Police Commissioner Michael Murphy argues not only has there been a reduction in crime, there's also been stronger engagement with young people and their families.
The main thing we've seen is really the absence of youth coming in and showcasing their criminal behaviour in the CBD and then like really decreasing the risk to them and their harmful behaviours. I'm engaging with the youth every night. We've seen really low numbers of the same youth coming in, and they've really been engaging with the youth workers to be returned home. But what's been different on this occasion, the follow-up by Territory families the following days, the actual families are asking for help about how they can better manage their children, and then that leads to pathways to education, school.
Marion Scrimger, who's the federal member for Lingiari based in Alice Springs, has backed the Chief Minister's extension of the curfew.
Well, I think it's been fantastic to be able to see Eva standing up and making some tough decisions, which hasn't gone down well with all sectors.
Some in Alice Springs had hoped the curfew would be extended beyond the end of the school holidays. Gavin Morris is a counsellor in Alice Springs and principal of Yiparinya School, which teaches about 350 students 4 Aboriginal languages and English.
All of our students and most of our staff come from the 17 town camps which surround the Alice Springs town centre. Given who we are and the students that we represent, we also cater for the most disadvantaged at-risk students in Central Australia, probably around the country.
Gavin Morris points out it's some of his students that have taken part in the antisocial behaviour that led to the curfew in the first place.
And the reason why they're in the town centre is because they don't see home as being safe. So we need to address the second part of the equation. The first part is being sorted out by the extension of the curfew, but let's be clear. The second part of the equation where our students, so many of them, view home as being unsafe, highlighted by domestic violence and sexual assaults, a lack of food security, overcrowding, and abject poverty, which there's no words to describe. And this is where our students come from and the conditions they have to endure. And it's because of that, what we're seeing on the streets of Alice Springs at the moment is a manifestation of having to live in these dire circumstances.
Robin Lamley, who's the independent member for Araluen, thinks the NT government needs to remain open to reinstating curfews in the future if it's needed.
Look, it's not the answer to all our problems. It's far from it. But it's just something that we now know can be implemented when things get really bad. We've got so much work to do when it comes to just sorting out the problems of a fairly small group of people in the community. Most of us get on with our lives, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, and we're just fed up with the level of crime and the problems in the town. So if we can get the kids off the street, it's such a good place to start. I think most people agree.
The Chief Minister will travel again to Alice Springs on Thursday, where she says there'll be further talks about longer-term solutions to the town's crime issues.
Gavin Koosh reporting. Australia's next Chief of Defence is to be the highly experienced Naval Commander David Johnston. He'll take over from General Angus Campbell in July. The Prime Minister's announcement of the appointment comes as the AUKUS nations, Australia, the UK and the US, consider inviting Japan to play a role in that alliance. For more on these developments, I spoke to Andrew Green, the ABC's defence correspondent. Andrew, Australia's next Chief of Defence has been announced. What do we know about Vice Admiral David Johnston's background?
Vice Admiral David Johnston has been in his current role as the second in command of Defence for the past 6 years. He's held many command responsibilities and joined the Navy as a 16-year-old cadet midshipman. But he is considered a safe choice and one that was generally expected. It's been 22 years since a Navy officer has been Chief of Defence, so he was certainly in the mix to get this job. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, when unveiling the decision and the changes at the top of the Defence Force today, did acknowledge the tricky strategic circumstances in which this official will now be overseeing the military for the next 2 years. Let's hear from Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
Vice Admiral Johnston is a proven leader with the experience, intellect and resolve to lead the ADF in a complex and rapidly changing global strategic environment.
Now, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese did obviously discuss the difficult circumstances. Similar questions were put to Vice Admiral David Johnston about the rise of China and other challenges, such as whether he supports stripping medals from defence personnel who've been linked to the Brereton Report findings. He didn't want to weigh into any of those difficult issues before he assumes the top job in July, but Vice Admiral Johnston did acknowledge that it is a daunting job, the one he'll soon be taking over.
I am very conscious of the responsibility that comes with the role, the strategic environment in which we face ourselves, and most particularly the responsibility I have to the extraordinary men and women in the Australian Defence Force and the families who support them.
Andrew, the possibility of Japan playing a role in the AUKUS alliance has been in the news today. What would its contribution be?
The AUKUS Security Partnership, as we know, is a grouping of three nations, Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States. Its primary or first objective is to get Australia nuclear-powered submarines. But there's a second pillar of AUKUS, which is focusing on other emerging defence technologies, such as hypersonics and AI and quantum, that sort of thing. And for several years now, ever since really AUKUS was first unveiled, there has been a debate over whether other like-minded nations could help cooperate on Pillar 2 projects. Well, that's gathering a bit more momentum. The three nations, their defence ministers overnight, released a statement in which it was acknowledged that there would be more discussion on allowing other parties to join some of those projects on a ad hoc basis. And the first one to emerge is Japan. The Japanese Prime Minister, incidentally, has flown into the United States and will discuss closer defence cooperation with US President Joe Biden.
One of the things that Pillar 2 is looking at is just that. That's what it's about, how we use new technology and cooperation. And if there can be gains that are in the interests of the three AUKUS partners, but in addition, any partners outside the direct AUKUS relationship, then that will be considered.
And Andrew, on a separate issue but still defence related, there have been attempts to get details of an agreement struck between Australia and Israel on defence industry cooperation, but those requests have been rejected. What's the latest on that?
Well, ever since the war in Gaza broke out late last year, there's been increased focus on military cooperation between Israel and Australia. The government has for some time insisted that there have been no Australian exports to Israel of military equipment for at least 5 years, so before the change of government, in fact. And since the killing of aid workers last week, including an Australian, there have been more questions asked about some of the equipment Australia is buying from Israel. Well, the Greens last year launched a Freedom of Information request to try to get a copy of the Memorandum of Understanding that was signed between Australia and Israel back in 2017 on defence industry cooperation. The Defence Department has now formally rejected that, citing that it could damage Australia's international standing if the sensitive details of that document were released publicly. The Information Commissioner has also acknowledged that the Israeli government was against the idea of releasing the document.
Andrew Green is the ABC's defence correspondent. The Federal Environment Minister has stepped into a long-standing fight in Queensland, flagging she'll reject a major development on internationally significant wetlands. Tanya Plibersek says the Toondah Harbour development south of Brisbane would have an unacceptable impact on the coastline and wildlife. Environmental groups are happy, but the local council is warning hundreds of jobs and billions of dollars will be lost if the project is shelved. This report from Stephanie Smale.
The now critically endangered Eastern Curlew has been drawing Judith Hoyle to southeast Queensland's Moreton Bay for decades.
I actually started going to the area in 1988. I was visiting with my husband and we went shorebird watching.
The birds use the Toondah Harbour tidal flats to fatten up over summer and rest after flying thousands of kilometres from Siberia or Alaska. So when a plan to develop the site surfaced about 10 years ago, Judith Hoyle was one of the first to start fighting it.
It's incongruous that a Ramsar site that provides habitat for this species would even be considered in the first place.
The $1.4 billion Toondah Harbour development was put forward by the Newman government, but carried on when Anastasia Palaszczuk took over. The Walker Group won the tender, and it's a big deal, including a marina, thousands of apartments and shops. But the Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek, says at this stage she plans to reject a proposal because of its impact on nearly 60 hectares of internationally significant wetland and the animals that rely on it. It's rare for the federal government to step in so late in the process, but Judith Hoyle and a string of other environment groups have welcomed the move.
Moreton Bay holds 75% of the overwintering population of eastern curlew. And it's not just the eastern curlew. Grey-tailed tattlers, Terek sandpipers, bar-tailed godwits.
The CEO of the Australian Conservation Foundation, Kelly O'Shaughnessy, is questioning how the proposal got this far over so many years.
Politics got in the way of good decision-making to protect nature. That has been happening in this country for decades now, and it is time that we have an independent national environment protection authority to make these decisions.
The federal government recently scrapped a wind farm project in Victoria, also due to unacceptable impacts on internationally significant wetlands there. Kelly O'Shaughnessy is hoping it's a sign of things to come.
They are currently rewriting the National Nature Protection Laws, and we would expect that in those laws they include these sort of upfront protections. So, hey, developers, don't come and ask me as the minister or the EPA to approve a development on an internationally important wetland or in a marine national park or in a World Heritage area.
While environmental groups have been battling against the project for years, the local council has been fighting for it. The mayor of the Redland City Council, Joss Mitchell, has only been in the job for 24 hours. But she says the project would inject up to $3 billion into the local economy, along with hundreds of jobs. She also argues the area is a busy tourism hub, and the port that's used to get people to nearby Stradbroke Island is in desperate need of an upgrade.
This harbour development provides critical transport infrastructure, and without this project, you know, it leaves a big question mark then around, you know, how these upgrades are going to occur.
The Redland City Council says the public-private partnership that involves developer the Walker Group must be allowed to move forward. The Walker Group hasn't responded to requests for an interview, instead sending this video message.
And we'll now take the time to carefully review and understand the reasons behind it, to ensure we provide the best opportunity for this important project to proceed, to deliver housing, jobs and new state government infrastructure, while ensuring world's best environmental practice.
The Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek, has allowed 10 days for further public comment before she makes a final decision.
The report from Stephanie Smale. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, when are you planning to retire? You may be disappointed to hear the average retirement age for Australians is increasing each year. Now to a tragic story about an Australian boy who took his own life after online scammers threatened to send intimate photos of him to his family and friends. After an international investigation, two men have now been arrested in Nigeria. They've been charged by local police with what are called sextortion offences. Amber Jacobs explains how Australian authorities managed to track down these alleged fraudsters.
The suicide of an Australian high school student shows just how devastating the consequences of a scam can be. He died just hours after receiving threats, demanding he pay $500 or have intimate images he'd been tricked into providing sent to friends and family. Richard Buckland is a professor of cybercrime at the University of New South Wales. He says this is certainly not the first victim of sextortion to take their own life.
Sextortion attempts like this have been increasing massively over the world over the last 3 years. We've seen mainly affecting teenage boys, and we've seen quite a few suicides worldwide. So this is actually a growing and very serious problem. In terms of how often do we catch people, what's the success rate there? Relatively small, but growing. There's only been a handful that I know of that have been caught in the last few years, but there are tens of thousands of attacks. It's estimated by the FBI happening every year.
The tragedy sparked a global investigation last year, and police say two men in Nigeria have been arrested and are now facing prosecution there. Richard Buckland says tracking them down would have been an extraordinary effort, involving local authorities in Nigeria, South Africa, and probably other international agencies.
Police are much more sophisticated than they were even 5 years ago, and we have international cooperation. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if colleagues in America in particular, and also in England, were helping the police with data requests and information from server logs and so on from the companies that host the services that the attackers would have been using. So we are slowly getting better at catching people, but still only a very, very small proportion of them are caught.
The alleged offenders will be dealt with locally in Nigeria, where authorities have the power to prosecute for Australian-based offences. David Holpen is Dean of Law at Southern Cross University.
These two men will be prosecuted in Nigeria under Nigerian law, but for actions at least partly which took place within Australia. Where there is this international impact and it leads to a death, I would hope to see much more serious charges laid than just scamming and blackmail. I mean, the outcome in this case is just so incredibly tragic and, in a way, quite predictable.
Reports of sextortion have been on the rise in recent years. According to Australia's eSafety Commissioner, reports tripled in the first quarter of 2023, with data showing victims most likely to be young men. Associate Professor Lennon Chang is from Deakin University's Centre for Cyber Resilience and Trust. While some might be surprised that Nigeria has made these arrests, he says it's part of a long-running effort to boost cooperation.
Well, I won't say it's surprising, but what we can see is there are more collaborations between the police in the African countries and countries like Australia, which is a very good thing, which also demonstrates that the countries like Australia or the US are putting more efforts and resources into training the police in those countries as well.
Associate Professor Chang expects arrests related to online fraud to become more common in developing countries.
We see that fraud and scam have become a very big issue in Australia and many other countries as well. So there will be more pressure that will be put on developing or underdeveloped countries in building up their capacity. Nigeria was just one of the examples. We see a lot of virtual kidnapping issues that were actually based in Southeast Asia, like Cambodia, Vietnam, or Laos.
If you're a young person who's the victim of sextortion or you know someone who is, you should report it by going to the Australian Centre to Counter Child Exploitation's website. The eSafety Commissioner can also help. And if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
Amber Jacobs reporting. The alleged murder of a young woman in regional Victoria is drawing attention to the scourge of violence against women in this country. It's believed Hannah Maguire is the 18th Australian woman to have allegedly been killed by a man this year. Advocates are urging the public to take action, both at home and in their communities, to help change attitudes to women. Isabel Masali reports.
Hannah Maguire's friends remember her as a bright young woman with a heart of gold. She was 23. And as her family struggles with grief, their lawyer Brooke Tamanika has this message.
As you can imagine, this is a very devastating time for the family, for Hannah's loved ones, and for our community as a whole.
She spoke outside the Ballarat courthouse today, where 21-year-old Sebastopol man Lachlan Young appeared, charged with murder. Last Friday, Hannah Maguire's body was found in the burnt-out wreck of a car in Ballarat South. The ABC understands Mr. Young and Miss Maguire were former partners. According to research group Destroy the Joint, there have been 18 deaths in Australia this year due to violence against women. Our Watch CEO, Patty Kinnersley, says as a community, we have to move past being upset and instead take action to prevent further murders of women.
People have to stop saying this is happening over there or this is happening in somebody else's family and or community. You know, a quote from Rosie Batty comes to mind there. And just look out more clearly for the signs that in every situation there will have been people who said, I don't like the way that man talks about his wife as something he owns. I don't like the way that person is talking disrespectfully about women. And we're not yet being brave enough as a community to step forward and say, we don't talk about women like that. Hey, mate, I think the way you're talking about your partners are not okay. So as a community, each of us individually have got to take more action now when we see the signs.
Dr. Che Brown is a domestic and family violence researcher with ANU who specialises in prevention. She says Australia's National Plan to End Violence Against Women and Children sets out an ambitious goal of ending the violence in one generation. But she warns significant government funding is needed.
And we can see with other public health problems, most notably COVID, for example, that when the government actually cares and when the public is invested, we see what can be achieved very quickly. Things can be changed. But when it comes to ending violence against women and intimate partner homicide, we don't see that kind of political will.
And in particular, Dr. Brown believes more funding on public health campaigns and early intervention programs will make a big difference.
So if we're going to prevent homicides, what we need to be able to do is assess risk. And there's a number of high risk factors that can indicate the likelihood of lethality. So what we would need is considerable investment and capacity building for police and healthcare workers and really across all sectors, so that people are able to identify and respond to that risk in a multi-agency way. So that means everybody working together, everybody having eyes on together, working to manage that risk.
As for what you can do in your life, Dr. Brown stresses the importance of education.
We know that very rarely do victim survivors report to formal agencies, people like police and healthcare and legal services. We know that most likely they're going to go to friends and family. So if we educate ourselves and we are aware of the signs, then we can all become that tellable person, that person who can be there, who can hear that disclosure and then encourage action for safety.
Dr. Che Brown from the ANU, that report from Isabel Massali. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, please call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. New figures show Australians are staying in the workforce for longer, with the average retirement age for men and women the highest it's been since the 1970s. Over the last two decades, the expected retirement age has steadily risen to about 66 for men and 65 for women. Rachel Hayter takes a look at what's driving this trend.
The age at which Australians retire has been increasing for 20 years. For men, it's now just over 66 years old, and for women, it's 64.8. And on a rainy Tuesday afternoon in Sydney, that seems a bit too long to wait for these commuters.
50? Yeah. 50 should be fine. People need to be rest.
What age do you want to retire?
Tomorrow.
Maybe early to mid-60s.
60 full-time and hopefully after that can cut back to part-time or casual work.
The data from KPMG shows despite that increase over the long term, the expected retirement age has remained unchanged for the last 2 years.
We saw this surge of people, older people remaining in the workforce or returning to the workforce during COVID.
Terry Rawnsley is an urban economist and the report's author.
These are people who might have normally retired, but you had border closures meant they couldn't travel the country or go overseas, and they were like, well, I can't travel, there's lots of jobs around, I'm going to keep on working.
There's still a difference in retiring age between men and women of about a year and a half, but over the last two decades, that gap has been closing.
Previously, there was a women could access the age pension at an earlier age than men, and that sort of drove a little bit of early retiring, but now those two numbers are in line.
The age people can access the pension influences when they decide to stop working. Professor in Ageing and Health at the University of Sydney, Lee Fay-Low, predicts last year's pension change may push the average retirement age older still.
The pension age was raised to 67, and that came into effect July 1st, 2023.
67 is just 2 years older than the threshold more than a century ago.
The pension age was set in 1909, 1910 at 65 for men, and it was 60 for women. When it was set then, the life expectancy was 55 for men and 59 for women. So your pension was the pension age was older than you were expected to live on average.
But now we're living much longer. The Australian Bureau of Statistics measures Australian life expectancy at 81.2 for men and 85.3 for women.
There's lots of discussion about old age dependency ratios, so how many people of working age to support people who are retired. This has also put pressure on the government.
A pressure felt by governments globally, not least in France, where last year workers held months of strikes and violent protests against increasing the pension age from 62 to 64.
If you live longer, you need to work longer.
Simon Kustenmaher is a demographer and co-founder of the Demographics Group. He argues the shifting nature of work is contributing to later retirement.
The reason for that being that a larger share of jobs that Australians hold are intellectual in nature. They are part of the knowledge economy.
And flexible working arrangements are also playing a role.
We've definitely seen the end of the gold watch type retirement. These days, more and more Australians slide into retirement.
Social researcher and demographer at McCrindle, Jeff Braley, says working from home also allows people to work for longer.
This new trend, this biggest change to work in 100 years, gives proximity and access to jobs, which is the number one factor the baby boomer generation are looking for when they're considering a new job.
Terry Rawnsley forecasts the age of retirement will continue to climb.
We've seen this sort of long-term trend over the last 20 years of sort of a 0.1 of a year increase every year. So if we think about that over the next 20 years, we'll probably be pushing towards that 70-year age mark.
And while our golden years might be further off than in days gone by, they're worth the wait, according to this retiree who, despite Sydney's rain, is delighting in her Tuesday afternoon.
I retired when I was 64. Loving it. Look how much we're walking with the young ones that they can keep up with us.
That report from Rachel Hayter. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Drugs, sex, and lavish dinners out. News organisations paying for interviews is hardly new, but the allegations about what Channel 7's Spotlight program gave to Bruce Lehrman for a sit-down interview are surprising to say the least. Today, Media Watch host Paul Barry unpacks what's unfolded. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.